Welcome to the Bright Vibe Podcast. At Bright Vibe, we believe everyone deserves to be happy. But in today's world, everywhere you turn, there is division and negativity. At Bright Vibe, we have created a global movement to bring 8 million people together who are inspired to live bright, live bold, and share bright vibes. Alone, it can be hard to change, but together we can change the world. Welcome to the Bright Vibe Podcast. Garrett Nyman, welcome to the Bright Vibe Podcast. So happy to have you on today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I'm going to read the title and then we'll dive into it just because I want to read the title because it's a cool title. I'm sure it gets a lot of attention. It's Rich White Men, What It Takes to Uproot the Old Boys Club and Transform America. There's nothing charged about that title at all.
Not at all. I found that 100% of people like it.
I'm sure. Right. Yeah. It's everything. Oh, that's a feel-good novel. So let's learn it first of all, though, let's get the background. You know, when somebody writes a book, obviously, it's written from their perspective and their perspective's based on their life. So tell us a little bit about who is Garrett and how did we come to this point that we wrote a book called Rich White Men?
Absolutely. I appreciate the question. So I grew up in Orange County, California, which you may know is a white, affluent, pretty conservative suburb of Los Angeles. And probably what shaped my life the most, other than growing up in those circumstances, was that my younger brother died in an accident. I was six. He was 2.5. It completely turned my family's whole life upside down, as you might imagine. And I think for a variety of reasons, I think that experience led me to a realization that life is short, or at least it can be, and wanted to live a meaningful life. And in a professional sense, that manifested as a commitment to social change that I always did volunteering growing up and, you know, wanted to find ways to help and be useful societally. But at the same time, I didn't have any systemic analysis related to race or class or gender or anything else. So I really got recruited into the dominant philanthropic mindset at the time, which for the most part is still the dominant mindset, which is really a charity orientation. And what does it look like to help others versus what I've come to see with the goal now is much more along the lines of what does it look like to build a healthy society that gives everybody the opportunity to have their needs met and to succeed. And this sense that a high inequality society does not enable that. And so it's been a whole journey that I could go deeper into, but the last 15 years has led me to that orientation and is a big part of the motivation behind Rich White Men.
And so let's go a little deeper then, since you've invited that into the conversation. So you grew up in Orange County. Were your parents affluent? Were they wealthy?
Yeah, my parents were wealthy. We always thought of ourselves as upper middle class. That's how, you know, me and my neighbors seem to describe ourselves. And it really wasn't until I saw data about the racial wealth gap that I started thinking of my family as rich, that I learned that, you know, the typical Black, Indigenous, Latinx family has almost no wealth, and that even having $1 million in wealth, that's about 1% of Black, Indigenous, and Latinx families. So for millionaire families that may be a long way away from the U.S. 1%, the demographic that Occupy poked at, are still, you know, through the eyes of Black, Indigenous, and Latinx folks, are extremely wealthy. So it really, that was what led to a reorientation on my part to think of myself and my upbringing as not just upper middle class, but actually rich.
Right. Okay. And so as I read your bio and did my show work, you went to Harvard. I think you went to both Stanford and Harvard, right?
Yeah, that's right. I went to Stanford for undergrad, and then I did an MBA and a master's in public policy at Harvard later.
Yeah. Those one are not that easy to get into, but also not cheap, right?
So yeah, absolutely. That, you know, I was very fortunate to grow up in a family that paid for most of my undergraduate tuition, and my parents paid for most of the tuition, and then my grandparents paid for the rest. I graduated from my undergrad debt-free, even from a private institution.
Well, okay. So you did come from some affluence and some wealth. I just wanted to put that in perspective that yes, you actually did grow up. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't think of upper middle class being able to afford both Harvard and Princeton.
And maybe one thing that would be helpful for me to explicit about actually is I think what I found is that most of the people I know, particularly as I've gotten to know very wealthy people. So I've spent my career as a nonprofit entrepreneur the past 15 years. And as I've met people on the very high end of the wealth spectrum, what I've seen is that pretty much everyone, or most of the people I know, talk about rich as richer than whatever they are. Like I've talked to folks who have hundreds of millions of dollars, how they say, oh, I don't have the influence of a billionaire. I've talked to billionaires who talk about how they don't have the resources of a Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. And if you go on the Gates Foundation website, Bill Gates actually talks about how he doesn't have as much money as some countries. You know, people shouldn't get his influence out of context. So, you know, that's really led me to try to look at rich differently. If we divide all the wealth in the world evenly, it's only $200,000 for a family of four. So if that's the size of the economic pie we have, and we have a high inequality society, it's inevitably going to be the case that most of the people have close to zero, which is the case.
Right. And I do want to delve into the book, and we'll give people a little bit, obviously, you know, what's in the book and why you wrote the book. But ultimately, why does Garrett care? You were given the opportunity to go to Harvard, to go to Princeton. You know, you had the options to choose what you wanted to do, where, you know, there's a lot of people in the United States, even, and we'll talk about the U.S. specifically, but there's a lot of people in the U.S. that don't feel like they have the ability to choose, right? You have to go get a job. You have to go to tech school. You have to go get a degree, right? That's just the way that I'm assuming you had these options. So why do you care so deeply about equality? Because you are a rich white man.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I gave you a piece of the story, but there's other pieces so I can fill it in a bit further. So I came into Stanford, as I mentioned, with that social change orientation, but without an analysis of how deeply rooted the systemic inequalities we have in our society are. Stanford is a place that really prizes social entrepreneurship as a pathway to social change. So I got very excited about that, was influenced by that. And the way I ended up focusing on education issues, and in particular college access through the nonprofit I started, was really seeing how rare it was for a student from a high poverty community of color to make it to a place like Stanford. That we talked about my family being quite well off, that we were very typical, or like wealth of that range was typical, and maybe even on the lower end at a place like Stanford. There really seemed to be these vast disparities in equal opportunity, which is what led me to start College Spring, that helped low-income students of color prepare for the SATs in college, and ran that organization for 10 years. And it was successful in many ways, raised $15 million, staffed to 25, served 19,000 students, got recognized by the Obama White House. But also, every year that I was in that work, it became really clear that programs like ours really were no match for extreme inequality, that there were so many barriers our students faced, like whether it was poverty or not having healthcare or not having glasses to read the blackboard, not having breakfast in their stomachs when they got to school in the morning. And on the list goes. And so programs like College Spring, while they do wonderful work, and I'm so proud of that work, it just felt like we needed to do something bigger, something deeper, something that got more at the roots of the issues. And along that journey, I was having all these conversations with philanthropists who very clearly had a lot of bias. That some of them were more biased, some were more bigoted, these closed room corner office type conversations. And you know, where the book starts, which I think is kind of at the beginning of me taking a different path, is I had a meeting with a billionaire financier. I think of like a Gordon Gekko type character. And when he found out that College Spring served all the students at the school, he said he didn't want his money going down the drain on the lazy kids. That if we supported high achievers, he'd be down for that. But, you know, that he doesn't want his money being wasted on kids who are just going to squander his resources, basically. And it really took that overt bias, that extreme kind of explicit in my base bias, to shake me out of my day to day and really start questioning what was going on. And if the way that I had been taught about how social change happens, the way Stanford had taught me that social change happens, that it seemed like there was a lot missing in that story. So it was really the beginning of me taking a big step back to really try to understand what are the root causes of inequality, how might they be addressed, and what is my role in that work as somebody who comes from a lot of advantages and doesn't come personally from the communities that are the most under-resourced. So that's really what kind of sparked this book was to explore that question of like, what is the role of a rich white man in advancing social justice? And it's something that there's not easy answers for. And frankly, I still feel like I'm trying to figure out those answers.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to dive into that. Yes, because when you read, obviously, the title of the book is written to entice and to draw in, right? Rich white men. You know, what it takes up. So are in the book, are you villainizing rich white men as the problem? Or what's the basis of the title and your theory, I guess, in the book?
It's a really good question. And I think certainly the, you know, the title can read that way a bit. The cover is a bit cartoonish with a Monopoly man.
Yeah, so you're right.
You can get a little bit of that from the title and the cover. I think what I've encouraged folks who bristle at that title and her cover is just to remind them very simply, don't judge a book by its cover. And the way that's relevant for this particular project is I really don't see this book as being focused on villainizing rich white men. Certainly, I share a lot of anecdotes like the one I just mentioned where rich white men have showed up to conversations about inequality, poverty, social justice in ways that demonstrate bias. But at the same time, you know, it's not rich white men who invented all of these issues. The issues of concentrated power goes back even further. Now, you know, 400 years plus is a long time. I don't want to minimize that, but this issue of power being concentrated in society and resources being concentrated in society is something that goes back a long time. And, you know, rich white men inherited that. The ones who are alive today didn't directly build those systems. Now, if they don't work to change those systems, then they're perpetuating them. And we have really big bubbles in our society that if you're a rich white man, that you're going to grow up in a gated community, and then you're going to go to private school, and then you're going to work at Goldman Sachs with other people who are from a similar background, and on we go. So there's a lot of ways that the system actually insulates rich white men and enables them to remain ignorant on these issues. And the journey for me, a lot of it has been really trying to get out of those bubbles and build really deep relationships across differences and really begin to take seriously the lived experience of people whose backgrounds are different from mine. And I think that if more rich white men made the effort to do that, I think we'd see some of their behaviors start to change.
And I agree. I grew up in Kansas, so it's a little bit less elitist, I would say, in the Midwest. And so typically in the Mid, we don't have the big name colleges. It's Kansas, it's wheat and it's oil and gas and airplanes and stuff like that. So I think the divide, while it is still a divide, is not as maybe noticeable on the surface. I'm not saying it definitely is still there. But when I've had conversations with, I'll just say, white businessmen, and I can think of one conversation I had in particular with there was five of us, and we're sitting around the table, and we were specifically talking about this because it was right after the George Floyd incident. And so we were really having an authentic conversation around it. And for the most, I would say these group of gentlemen, they're real world people, but they are rich white men, and they're rich white men either through building what they owned, or one of them was a banker, but they were all affluent, I would say, even for Kansas, they were affluent. There's a lack of education with the people who have the resources to actually know what to do with the resources to help. There's like this missing bridge, and maybe your work is part of that bridge, but it seems like that there's like this, the people with the resources are kind of like, I don't know exactly how to deploy these, because I think when you do have resources and you invest and or donate, you don't always know how they're getting used. You don't know how, and how are they affecting the outcome? I've literally seen studies where a lot of the not-for-profit organizations out there that are supposedly helping are actually not helping. They're actually just perpetuating the problem, and it's a self-sustaining. It's like if they actually solve the problem, the organization wouldn't exist. So the organization is not going to, and it's not that they're doing it intentionally. There's nothing mean about it. It's just if my organization exists to fight a certain problem, and then that problem, we solve that problem, then my organization no longer ceases to be, if that makes sense.
I think one of the things that you mentioned is this notion that there's a lot of folks out there, wealthy white folks, wealthy white men in particular, who are well-intentioned, who want to help and are struggling to figure out how to do that. And I do think that it is very much the case that I think of it as being under-supported in this kind of flipping the frame on, I think there's a tendency in our society to say that, you know, that those who are from low socioeconomic backgrounds or from certain racial backgrounds or whatever, those are the ones who need help, who need education, who need support in order to contribute. And I think it's actually much closer to the opposite, that those right. who hold wealth and power in society are missing that education, those skills and so forth to participate in building an equitable society. And I think part of what demonstrates this is that there are historical examples of individual privileged people who made an incredible difference. And a lot of these are stories that many of us haven't heard. I think of somebody like Sidney Levinson, who was Dr. King's closest white friend in the civil rights movement. He was behind the scenes, helped raise money, helped hire staff, helped write speeches. They would actually collaborate on speeches to try to negotiate out how does Dr. King convey his message in ways that would effectively reach white audiences, but not be watered down or lose the key points that King thought were important. There were very intentional ways that they did this bridge building that you mentioned, connected across differences, and basically leverage those differences in order to create more social change than either of them could have independently. And those models are really hidden in our society. Mm-hmm. If you're a wealthy white man who's trying to follow in Stanley Levinson's footsteps, you have to do a lot of digging to even discover
he exists. Right, exactly. So yeah, I'd never heard of him.
Most people I talk to haven't. Even people who are pretty knowledgeable about the civil rights movement haven't necessarily come across it. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to lift up those examples, those stories, lift out the best practices of those bright spots, both historically and on a contemporary basis. There's groups like the Solidaire Network, which is a progressive donor network of wealthy white folks who fund social movements that are trying to build the 21st century civil rights movement in this country. There's Patriotic Millionaires, which is wealthy folks who are advocating for higher taxes on the wealthy because they see that as ultimately in our national interest. There's White Men for Racial Justice that is getting off the ground now. So there's both many historical examples and contemporary examples of people doing things differently. And I find that I think the most important thing or the biggest obstacle is just not feeling lonely in the work. I think that there's a lot of folks who they want to make a difference. They don't know anyone in their bubbles who's doing that. Right. And it can feel controversial. It can feel dicey. You can feel fearful that you're going to alienate family or friends, you know. So what does it look like to join a community like Solidaire or Patriotic Millionaires or White Men for Racial Justice to have that community of folks who are navigating the same societal challenges from a similar identity, location, and society? I found to be invaluable for my own learning and growth and long-term commitment to the issues.
Yeah, I love it. And then, so in the book, what is the premise of the book then? What are some of the, one question I wanted to ask was, what was your biggest aha that you didn't expect? Like when you were doing your research, when you're diving into this, like what was one thing that you found that you were like, wow, that was the opposite of what I thought, or I would have never guessed that when I started? That makes sense.
Yeah, so I'll try to answer both of your questions. So first of all, in terms of the structure of the book, so it's two parts. The first part is how the Old Boys Club reproduces itself. And then the second part of the book is becoming equitable. Mm-hmm. So the first half of the book really focuses or it anchors on a term I came up with called compounding unearned advantage. It's a new term. It's not a new idea, but it's a different way of talking about privilege. So basically, compounding unearned advantage is this idea that seemingly small identity-based advantages, when they show up at key moments in our lives, they change trajectories. I give an example of how in second grade, I didn't get the test scores I needed on the exam to be labeled gifted at my school, but there was a district workaround where your teacher could submit a portfolio and my teacher did that for me.
Yes.
And obviously I can't say with certainty that was because I was white or because I was male or whatever, but we do have these studies that say white teachers typically see their white students as higher potential. We have studies that show that parents Google more often, is my son gifted? That is my daughter gifted? That we know that teachers in affluent communities have more time to invest in their students, that parents have more time to advocate for their children. When we look at that structural context, like it's not hard for me to imagine that if I wasn't in the position I was, that I wouldn't have gotten that extra opportunity. And that changed the whole trajectory of my life. That's what got me into small classes with the best teachers and AP courses, which was necessary for Stanford and everything that came after that. So that's really what the first half of the book is, really flushing out this idea of compounding unearned advantage in a variety of different lenses. And then the second half of the book is really focused on how do we challenge compounding under an advantage? If it's going to be the case that even a little bit of bias is enough to generate these large disparities, how do we actually tackle them as a society? And the first half of part two is really focused on some big policy ideas, more progressive taxation on the wealthy, abolishing poverty, not just reducing it, but abolishing it outright, which is something that Dr. King wanted to do before he was murdered, reparations and building a culture of repair and so forth. And then the latter chapters really try to make a case for why equitable America is good for all of us. Some of that is about, as a country, having a stronger democracy, economy, and so forth. But on an individual level, there's things that even the privileged have to gain from equity, that it's having closer relationships across differences and having more diversity of experience and perspective in your life. It's for men being able to access more of our emotions and not blowing up at our kids and spouses, even killing ourselves, that men have much higher suicide rates, maybe partly because of not being able to get their emotions out effectively. So there's all these ways where an equitable society actually serves even the advantage. Mm-hmm. And what does it look like to try to make a case to elites that what we have to gain from an equitable America is more than what we have to lose? And I don't have any illusions that I or even the collective we on this is going to convince 100% of elites to move in that direction. But what I found is that if even a small number of folks move significantly to really dig deep into the work, to redistribute wealth, to social justice movements and so forth, they can have a transformative impact on our society. So that's really my focus.
And something you said, which I think in I would like clarity around this, when you say redistribution of wealth, because that's all we could have just put that on the title of the book and said, let's redistribute wealth. And that would have been just as hot a topic as rich white men, I think. So when you say redistribution of wealth, what does that look like for you?
Sure. There's different ways of looking at it. And I think the first thing I like to emphasize is that currently we have a redistribution of wealth upward, like that when you look at how low taxes the ultra wealthy pay through capital gains and the army of accountants they hire. There's the corporations have, I think it's 10 accountants for every employee at the IRS. Like, this is not a fair fight that we're in here. And so some of that is just, what does it look like to, you know, have policies that, like, first just prevent the redistribution upward? Like, we're literally subsidizing the ultra rich, and we're also subsidizing the moderately rich, like things like, we are renting now, but we owned a home previously and we got a mortgage tax deduction every year. You know, that I came from a wealthy family. I paid for my down payment with a gift from my grandmother. And then the government writes me what you might call like a handout check every year because I bought a home using money I didn't earn. There's all these strange ways that we have, some people call them upside down tax policies that actually lead the redistribution to be upward. So that's part one, is like, how do we actually stop it from going the wrong direction? But then also, what does it look like to have a progressive tax policy that basically takes into account that, you know, that wealth compounds? Like, that if you're a wealthy person, you're going to get richer and richer. Your money's going to double every 15 years or 10 years or 5 years or two or three years these days for some folks. If that's what's happening, regardless of how hard you're working, how much you're contributing, it's going to have to take a pretty aggressive, pretty progressive tax policy to actually level the playing field and really invest in our whole country. That it's, I find it bizarre actually that we have as much wealth inequality as we do, and that anybody could claim that we're anywhere near close to having equal opportunity. That in a capitalist system, you know, that if you have access to capital, you're advantaged. It's called capitalism is because having capital is helpful. And, you know, that if we have such this big disparity, then, you know, how much money people start with, we're going to continue to see this compounding under advantages play out in our society.
So statistically, lottery winners go bankrupt much more than the average person goes bankrupt, right? Because they're given capital, but they're not given education, right? They're not, it's unearned capital versus earned capital. And I'm not disagreeing with your, with some of the statements you've made, but in essence, if we're taking from the rich and giving to the poor, that doesn't solve anything. If there is no understanding of how to build, create, and maintain wealth, it's an education issue, because we can provide capital. We can provide capital, but if there's no education on how to do that or how to maintain it and how to keep it, then it's like the lottery winners and everybody. I've seen this in my own life. I came from a very poor background. I did not have rich parents. I did not get the college education paid for. And obviously, I did have advantages of being a white man, but it wasn't something that somebody gave me something. I earned it through collaboration, cooperation with other human beings. So how do we fix the education problem?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think I don't want to dispute the notion that there is an education piece of it. Meaning if, you know, that if your family has never had wealth before, that you might not know how to evaluate the details of a mortgage or where to get the most return on your money, or you might pay for a financial advisor that takes a lot of fees when you could put it just in a retirement fund at Vanguard or something like that. There's definitely educational pieces to this, and there's a lot of government efforts, nonprofit efforts, corporate efforts that are focused on financial literacy. When all of those things are happening and we're still seeing the wide inequality that we have, I think I'm really encouraged by what the data shows about a universal basic income pilot program. Mm-hmm. Some people talk about a universal basic capital too. Baby bonds is an example of that. Like when I look at, for example, Mayor Michael Tubbs's Stockton Empowerment Project that really piloted a guaranteed income for the first time in the U.S. in a substantial way, that people did a lot better. I think the lottery example is an interesting one because I think it does take a lot of sophistication to manage hundreds of billions of dollars. I think for people who are used to being destitute and have a little bit more resources to, you know, to make slightly different decisions, that for the most part, and the Stockton data shows this, like, they buy their kids breakfast so they could pay attention during school. I think the American dream is pretty simple, is maybe what I'm trying to say, that it's get your kids an education, buy a house. You know, like, I think most people in America actually know how to do that. And it's more about them having the resources to do that and whether their communities have the resources to have a culture that helps enable that.
I'm really curious about the universal basic income, right? When he first introduced that, how did it go? I did not actually hear the results of that experiment. How is it going? Because that was about 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago when they implemented that. Is that right?
Yeah. So this was a few years ago, and there's a bunch of experiments underway now in other places. Mm-hmm. So it builds on a lot of similar efforts around the world. Like GiveDirectly, for example, has been doing this in a whole bunch of countries internationally. They do direct cash transfers in the US now as well. So there's a lot of examples in stock. And I think what they found is really that it helped free people up a little bit so that they can make better long-term choices. And I think, you know, because I know a lot of entrepreneurs and business people that, like, if you're almost out of cash, like if your company has a week of cash or you're in debt and your lenders are coming after you, that leads to a very short-term orientation. Right. So I know some rich white men who complain about, oh, how people in poverty, they don't take the long view. Like, they really can't, I think, for the most part, because it really is like a week by week survival type experience. And so what the Stockton experiment found is, like, people got food in their stomachs, they got more stable housing in some cases, and then they were able to look a little big picture. So for example, I think one of the things that surprised folks maybe is that a lot of people actually switch jobs. So they use the extra income to take a few days off of work so they could actually apply for a higher paying position. That if you're somebody who's working 80 hours a week in minimum wage jobs and you're going to get fired if you ever miss a shift, how do you even apply for another job if you're qualified for one? So that little bit of freedom, I think, goes a long way. And I think the analogy of cash-strapped businesses holds pretty well. If you're a bootstrap startup and you get some angel money, you're going to do things differently than if you didn't have that.
And I think there's pluses. I remember during the tech bubble, more businesses went out of business that actually got the angel funding than didn't, just because they didn't know how to be resilient. But that was because they just, it was free money to them. This is a little different where you're talking about those basic human needs, right? We're talking about shelter, food, clothing.
And we're talking about thousands of dollars, not millions of dollars. Or the lottery example, hundreds of millions of dollars.
We should take care of each other as a general principle, right? There, having somebody struggling in that way doesn't add any value to society, right? It doesn't make society better. Or if I have an extra $5,000 in my bank, but that guy can't eat, that's not good for the whole vibe of the earth, right? That's not a fair and equitable way to live.
you know, how many Einsteins and Google founders and so forth, just like our world has missed because that person was focused on trying to get enough to eat that day instead of really using their gifts to the fullest. I think some people say, oh, if we had less wealth inequality, that people wouldn't have the incentive to start tech companies and so forth. But I think if the grand prize were $10 billion instead of $100 billion, I think people would be plenty motivated. And I would rather bet on millions of additional people having a shot at producing those kind of innovations than putting all of our eggs in the basket of rich white men who go to a handful of universities.
Like when George Floyd died, I didn't have any experience of that, right? I worked with Black people. But I mean, that I consider friends to this day, but I didn't really have an experience. I didn't know their experience. And so for me, I literally just put out on Facebook, George Floyd's picture. And I said, what are you going to do about this? Here's what I want to do. I want to get together and just have a talk. And so I brought 20 people together that just respond. And we just sat down. And I said, I got a question. Let's just get in small. Let's just have some conversations because I am just ignorant when it comes to this. I actually learned a lot through conversations, candid, very candid conversations with people of color. Because I just had no clue of their experience. Like the manager of this company that I was running, he said, when I drive by a cop car, I sweat. He said, literally, I break out in sweats. He said, our parents teach us that when we get pulled over by a policeman, we put our hands on the dash and we say, yes, sir, no, sir. And we leave our hands on the dash. Otherwise, we could be killed. I was like, Ryan, are you like, right now? He goes, if I get pulled over today, I put my hands on the I'm like, oh my God. So for me, it was just ignorance, right? It was just lack of education. And when I say education, I'm not a book educated, lack of education about what it is to live somebody else's experience. And so I'd love to see part of this be the education is just bringing people together to have those conversations. So we break down those barriers so that we don't have people misunderstanding. Like once I had much more empathy for an ethnic person's situation than I ever did before, just because we had a couple hour conversation, it totally shifted. Wow. In my world, I mean, I will argue with a police officer if he pulls me over. If I'm driving 9 miles an hour over and he wants to give me a ticket, I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm giving him lip. I'm not worried about dying. And I'm just like, are there catalysts for those conversations to be happening out there between these different groups?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to share a little bit of a reaction that ties back to the book. I'll come to this more directly, that I think one of the reasons why I wanted to write a book about rich white men specifically is that having attended elite universities, I meet a lot of wealthy white women and a lot of wealthy Black men. And it was really through those relationships like that it is the case that if you're a wealthy white woman in the US, you feel oppressed. Like you feel that bro culture in companies, right. You might not feel safe when you're walking around at night, on and on we could go. And the wealthy Black male experience has some of those similar characteristics. I know Black guys who work in private equity, but if they get pulled over by a cop, they're going to respond in the exact same way that your friend did. And it doesn't matter how much money you make or what schools you went to, that all they see is the color of your skin. And, you know, that I think that one of the challenges in our society is that I think we tend to look at these systems almost as if they're separate. Oh, we're going to look at white privilege, or we're going to look at patriarchy, or we're going to look at class. And if you're a wealthy white woman or a wealthy Black man or a white man in poverty, for example, you say, wait, like this doesn't actually fit my experience very well. Yes, I might have this advantage. A white man in poverty doesn't feel like he has a lot of advantage, and he's right to say that. That was one thing I want to emphasize about this book. And I think in terms of your broader question about dialogue, I think, first of all, I would say like this book is intended to be like survey or landscape in some ways of the latest evidence related to equity, that it's a, I think it's an approachable book. It's a narratives driven book, but it also, it has 700 citations that it covers a range of topics, a one-stop shop to get acquainted with the issues. We have reading guides for people who want to do book clubs and things like that. But also, yeah, there's a lot of other ways to do that that we have on our website. We have a long list of like other books you could consider reading, groups you could join to have these discussions, groups you could join to take action if you've already done that discussion part and you want to be in space with people who are also donating money or getting involved or whatever it may be.
Nice. And what's that website, since you mentioned it, what's the website?
Yeah, just my author website, which is garrettneiman.com. So G-A-R-R-E-T-T-N-E-I-M-E-N.com.
Perfect. And so there's ways to have discussions around. And I'm just encouraging myself and everybody listening or everybody watching, what can we do in our own lives to continue the conversation? This is bigger than any one person's going to solve, but it's going to take individuals to solve it. There's no getting out of that. We have personal responsibility for bridging those gaps always, right? It's not just if you're a person that feels like that you have disadvantages, I would encourage you to talk to somebody that you think has advantages and start to find common ground. And if you're a person that is like myself, that was ignorant to some of the advantages that I had, definitely reach out and find people that don't feel that way and start to have those conversations. As a human being, you naturally start to gravitate. At least what I have found is typically you try to find commonalities. There's something about being human, especially just one-on-one. The group dynamic is different, but in a one-on-one situation, there's almost this grace that enters in that where you want to try to connect, even if you do feel like they have opposite views, you want to try to connect. So how am I connecting? How are we connecting with people that are not like us, right? Because otherwise we're not going to bridge this thing together. And to your point, it doesn't do anybody any good to have this much conflict and strife and inequality. Any final thoughts, things that you would want to make sure we got across? I like to phrase this question. If you had one message to give to all 8 billion people that live across this rock we call Earth, and you just had the one message to give and then boop, you were vaporized off the Earth, what would be that one message that you would want to get across to help people?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I want to speak to your question first about anything that we missed, and then I'll get to that. So just one thing that I wanted to bring up is that this project is structured as a royalties cooperative. What that means is that what would have been my author royalties has been divided in 7 shares. I'm keeping one of those shares, but the remaining 6 are going to social justice organizations. So 86% of my author royalties are going to social justice groups. And in exchange for that, they're serving as accountability partners and guidance partners for the project. It's a model that we feel really good about. And I think that enables, you know, me to step into this work. You know, book is an exercise of power. Right. It could also be a wealth consolidation opportunity for yet another white man to build wealth. So we wanted to do this differently. So I wanted to mention that. And in terms of your question about advice for folks on the whole planet, I feel pretty reluctant because all of us have lived experiences that are so different. But I think one thing that has some universal elements to it is this notion that every single one of us has a sphere of influence. There's ways that we can change ourselves, improve ourselves. That's the core of our sphere of influence. But then there's family, friends, professional contacts. If you went to college, alma maters, that there's all of these relationships that we have that we can influence folks. And so in that sense, every one of us has some degree of power to help build an equitable society. Some have more power than us, clearly. Yeah. What does it look like to really understand what is my location? What are the advantages I have? What can I contribute? Who can I influence that other people might struggle to influence for whatever reason? And really try to look at it in a way that's both ambitious, like I really can move my sphere of influence, and also humble that my sphere of influence is not unlimited. And that's actually a good thing because we don't want anyone to have that amount of power. I think that's what I would offer if I had to pick one thing.
Perfect. Well, Garrett, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Congratulations on your book. I hope it does extremely well and it fulfills lots of different purposes to be a catalyst for positive change in the world. So thank you so much for doing the work. I truly am humbled and honored to have spent the last hour with you. And as things evolve, you are always welcome to come on the show and talk about anything that you've got on the top of your mind or any new revelations. We're always here. We call it Bright Vibe Podcast for a reason. It's how do we put out bright vibrations? How do we lift the vibration of humanity? So thank you for being a part of that lift today, and we certainly appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being a part of the Bright Vibe Podcast. For more information, go to brightvibe.com. That's B-R-I-T-E, vibe, V-I-B-E.com. Thank you for listening.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.